Welcome to another episode of Shooting the Shit with literary agents Carly Waters and Cece Lira, where we dissect publishing gossip, discuss book industry trends, and the overall state of the book business. If you've ever wanted to grab a coffee with two literary agents, grab your mug and pull up a chair. Hello, Cece. It's nice to see you after our week off, as I made an Instagram reel about. It was quite a week that we didn't choose to be off necessarily, but that was our bye week, which for you non-sports people means take a week off. That is a sports term, I will admit. But yeah, how are you doing? And since I haven't seen you.
I didn't know that was a sports term. I thought you made it up. I thought it was a good thing. Interesting.
No, it's like when you're in a tournament or you're like doing a round robin. I don't know, with your sportsings against the various teams. Your bye is like your week off.
Interesting. I thought it was a Carly thing. It's still a Carly thing, but yeah, too much happened.
I know.
It was a lot. Oh my gosh. I feel like we were texting each other, like all the things, and what a week to be off. But today is April 1st though, which means it's April Fool's. I know it's not airing on April Fool's, but we are recording on April Fool's. Do you partake in April Fool's? Historically, have you?
I was just looking back through my Canva, you know, how like, you know, I make images for social media. I was like, I thought I did a good April Fool's one time on Canva, because sometimes I'll recycle Canva posts. And I went back and I found one that I made for the podcast account like 3-ish years ago. And any longtime fans of the pod probably remember this. But I posted early in the morning on April the 1st, like, it was like kind of a multi-page carousel, and it's like big news. And then the next carousel is like, the shit no one tells you about writing has changed our stance on prologues. After immense reflection, we have decided that we are actually in favor of prologues. We were wrong all along, and we will now only accept submissions with prologues. Anyway, it got a few people, but most people were like, oh my God, I knew it was a, you know, April Fool's right away. But I'm not traditionally very good at it. I kind of forgot about it. My kids tried to punk me this morning. They have this like robotic lizard. They have multiple robotic things, but they have like this robotic lizard that climbs on the floor. They also have like a robotic bug that climbs on the wall. So they were like trying to get me with their robotic insects and lizards.
Oh, that's cute. Aw, babies. Yeah. I know they're not babies anymore, but I think as long as kids are little, I call them babies.
Yeah, they're smaller than you.
Yeah. I'm terrible at April Fool's. I always fall for the jokes and the puns. And I'm like, I never realize it's April Fool's. I remind myself every morning, it is April Fool's. Do not believe things. And I'm always like, huh? What? I always forget 5 minutes later. So
I didn't see very many good ones today. I don't know if it's because the world is just like, you know, the dumpster fire that it is. People are like, we don't need to cause more chaos today. So, you know, there was that. But I just want to give a brief overview of the topics we're going to cover today. And then I want to know about what you're reading right now. We have a lot to cover. We have a lot to talk about with AI. One of the running joke now on the show is like, we can't go a week with, like, can we go a week without talking about AI? And then it was like, we cannot go a week without talking about AI. Then we will definitely not go 5 minutes, probably, especially this episode, without talking about it. So we have a lot to talk about regards to AI. We also need to talk about different closures of imprints in publishing and kind of like layoffs that have been happening. We have three on the docket to talk about today. And there's been some interesting Instagram threads. I don't know how much time we're going to have today. We might run out of time, but I also wanted to talk about nonfiction, the state of nonfiction a little bit. And if we don't get to that today, that's going to get bumped to next week. But what are you reading right now, Cece? I know we were talking before we hopped on to record that you're not sleeping very well. So are you reading if you are not sleeping?
Yes, always. I'm always reading. I want to get the author's name because I know the title of the book, but I don't know the author's name. And we're trying to practice name linkage. I just finished. Oh my God, this is going to be one of my top favorite books ever. That is how much I loved this book. Okay? Wow. I'm obsessed. So it is called Lady Tremaine.
Oh, yeah.
I was excited about it when I saw the announcement for it. And the author is Rachel Hochhauser. I hope I'm pronouncing Rachel's name right. It's like a Cinderella reimagining from the evil stepmother's, there's air quotes around this, perspective. Yeah. And it is brilliant. It is pacey and plotty and fun and commercial and deep and intelligent and filled with commentary and prompts you to ask interesting questions. Like, it is so good. Like, I am completely obsessed with this book. And it's going to become one of my all-time favorites. I just know it. I just know it because when I finish a book that's really, really, really good, something happens inside of me where, like, my favorites kind of just slot into place, you know? Like, oh, and I'm just completely obsessed with it. It's so imagining, good. It's so good.
I'm imagining that happening. My client, EJ Dixon, author of One Bad Mother, did a launch event with Rachel for Lady Tremaine.
Oh, fun.
So that's an interesting linkage of those two books, One Bad Mother, Lady Tremaine, because EJ did it in conversation with the author, I think a couple weeks ago. So I love when our book worlds collide.
Yes.
I got a bunch of great delivery. Firstly, I got to show you my great deliveries that I've got. I've been making some Instagram reels. I try to, every time a box, you know, client box gets delivered, I get ARCs delivered and I get finished copies delivered, obviously, of all of my books, as well as things that I order. So yeah, I got a great stack here right now. So this book, Where the Sea Lavender Grows, Kitty Johnson, this book is an Amazon First Reads pick today, April 1st. And so anybody who is a subscriber to First Reads can pick this up. Otherwise, everybody else can grab it on May 1st. So this beautiful box just got delivered. The finished copies of Cleo Dang Would Rather Be Dead just got delivered. So
which
I haven't made my video.
In like a couple weeks, right?
Yeah, that's on the 14th. Yeah, and anybody in Toronto, I will be at the launch. If you go to Mai's page, Mai Nguyen is my author. Cleo Dang Would Rather Be Dead. If you go to her page, it has all the information about her launch event in Toronto, downtown on April 14th. I will be there. And yes, we got our beautiful finished copies, which looks amazing. And Mai is also going to be doing an event with me in Ottawa. We're bringing her up for the Ottawa Writers Festival, May 13th. So anybody in Ottawa, please come to that event through the Ottawa Writers Festival. And you can also see me there. Another beautiful book, I got the ARCs for Midsummer Nights. This is the retelling. Oh, I already told you guys about this one. Yeah, this is my retelling of Shakespeare. So I've been keeping this nearby. Whenever I do editor calls, I like to have my books nearby because you know, when we're on Zoom, so I like to kind of hold them up.
Yeah, for sure.
And our ARCs for Love Wells Kept, which is the final book in the Wells Ranch series, which is, a little bit sad. So this one's coming out in the summertime. So we got our ARCs nice and early. But this one is about our rancher gets a traumatic brain injury and he doesn't remember his family and has to kind of fall back in love with, you know, his wife and his child again. And so it's like really deep and obviously very emotional. And I love my cowboy series and they're all, you know, have this extra layer of heart and family. So that's my huge stack that I have beside me that I've been sharing with editors. It's a lovely stack.
ARCs are the best. ARCs are the best. Yeah. It's just the coolest thing to get an ARC.
I know it is. You're like, wow, this is going to be a book soon. And for fun, I started reading. Well, I go through, I always do the, I look through the kind of award lists. And the Women's Prize for Nonfiction shortlist was announced probably 1 or 2 weeks ago. And I kind of scroll through, I'm like, I don't know what's going to catch my eye. But a really great book did, which was Art Cure. And it's all about the science of art therapy. So it's like art and science together in one book, which I'm loving. Really good. So I'm really enjoying that, called Art Cure. And yeah, that's kind of what's in my head right now.
That's really cool. I want to read that book now, Art Cure. It sounds awesome. My next read is also going to be an ARC. I got the ARC for The Shampoo Effect by Jenny Jackson. So excited to read. I loved Pineapple Street and I'm really excited for this. There's this thing that happens to me. I'm so dumb. Whenever I read a second book by an author that I really, really loved, I'm always like afraid to start the second book because what if I don't love the second book as much? With Ashley Audrain's The Push, this happened. Like, I adored The Push so much. And then I was like about to read The Whispers. It was also an ARC. And I'm like, what if I don't love this as much? Who cares if I don't love it as much? Ashley's not going to care. Yeah. No one's going to care. But I am like actually afraid. There should be a word for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I loved The Whispers and just as much as The Push. It was so good. And again, I'm so excited to read The Shampoo Effect, but because it's me and like I'm governed by fear, I'm like, oh my gosh, what if I don't love it as much? As though that matters to anyone but me.
Yeah. Yeah. I've already pre-ordered that one. So maybe I'll steal your ARC when you're done. But yes, it's already on its way to me. Emma Straub's book, I also pre-ordered that one. So yeah, lots of great stuff coming out as we move into the spring and summer reading time. Okay, so let's kind of get into things we have to talk about today. So I don't even know where to start at this point with all of the AI conversations, just because anybody who has been following all of the publishing news is probably familiar with a lot of it. I also know that some of you guys aren't as glued to your screens like I am, so that maybe we should give a little precursor to kind of what happened. So I do want to run you guys through a little bit of factual information about some of the things that we're talking about. So there was a book, which again, you might have heard about by now, called Shy Girl, author Mia Ballard. And this book was canceled because of suspected use, or, you know, depending on the way that you read it, proven use of AI to create or co-create the text of the book. So I'm going to run you through just a quick little recap of the timeline in case, again, people aren't familiar with the entire story. I'm grabbing this timeline from Brooke Warner's Substack because she did such a great job of kind of summarizing it. Writerly Things with Brooke Warner. She said, how could this have happened? And I'm going to give you guys the recap from her article. So February 2025. So we're going back a whole year here. 2025. Shy Girl was self-published. And according to Brooke, well-reviewed, you know, well-received, had 5,000 ratings on Goodreads, an average of 3.5 stars, according to the New York Times. July 2025, despite knowing that the author lifted the artwork from Wynn Lewis for her self-published edition, which is a whole other side story worth looking into, Brooke says, because it speaks to the author's lack of regard for ownership, Hachette US buys the North American rights to Shy Girl. So we're still in 2025. November of 2025, Hachette UK publishes its edition with a new cover. March 19th, now we're moving up to the present. March 19th, Hachette US, with yet another variation on the cover, announces it's canceling publication of the North American edition set to come out in April. And now is when you probably are relatively caught up if you've been reading the news. There was multiple New York Times articles about this. There was a Walrus piece. You know, I don't even know how many Substacks were written on the topic. Cece, did I miss anything? How does that sound? Did I get it all right?
I will be honest with you. Part of what I was going to say when we talked about this is,
yeah,
I am confused on the facts. Like,
okay.
I'm not saying, I have no opinion on whether you're right or wrong. Like, I hope you're reading off the article. I am confused on the facts because I have read so much on this topic.
Yeah.
And I don't know what actually happened. Like, the author claims she did not use AI. That's an important piece of the information. And
I think at one point she does admit to it, though. Yeah, yeah.
I think she says the editor she hired used it.
Yeah.
But not her. If she admitted it, I missed that. I guess that's part of what, there are so many articles on this topic. And I consider myself to be a reasonably intelligent person, and I'm still confused over what happened because it's so hard to get facts straight in this flooding of information world we live in. Anyway, what I'm saying is I am listening. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think, you know, there's a lot of tangents we need to go off on in regards to this, but the fact that there is so much misinformation or half information, half baked thoughts, I'm also confused a little bit about. So one of the reasons this came to the attention of the New York Times was because of a writer, and I don't even know if they call themselves a journalist, but this writer, you know, came forth saying, I put this through AI software to figure out, like AI identifying software to figure out whether this had AI in it, because there were so many reports online and on Reddit and on YouTube about this potentially being AI. And then they brought all of this reporting to the New York Times. This person is Thad McElroy, publishing industry consultant, is how they describe themselves. To my knowledge, you know, they're a writer. Yeah, so that's the part that I'm like, okay, but did the New York Times like verify all of this? Did Hachette just react to the fact that the New York Times was coming out with this big expose and then feel like they had to react by pulling it? Clearly, Hachette wasn't out in front of the information, or they were waiting to see if all of this, you know, kind of came to light. Like, it's all of it's very confusing. Like, a publisher would never intentionally try to get themselves in a legal situation. So it's just very strange.
Right. It's very strange. And I think that amid so much that's happening and so much content being produced by it, the thing that really sticks with me is how much of all of this is about trust.
Like, yeah.
We live in a world where trust is eroding little by little, like almost every day and on so many fronts. And I experience it personally. I know you do too. We as humans, trust is a big issue in our world right now, or lack thereof. And trust in institutions like publishers. Like, publishers need to vet the books they publish. Trust in media outlets, you know, how much fact checking is happening, you know, are sources being given credit? And trust, of course, in authors too. And the part that most breaks my heart, I'll be honest with you, like the thing that most stands out to me is writers have it so hard as is.
I know.
And over the years, things have been getting harder and harder. Declining readership, a huge number of new books being published. It just keeps increasing and increasing. Publishers grabbing more rights. Attention spans declining. So much competition with social media and other media formats. Like, it's just so hard to be an author. And then we decided to add AI to the equation because the world apparently wasn't hard enough. I kept thinking about, you know, all the threats that AI could bring. And now there's a new one that I didn't even think to consider, and I should have, which is an author could be unfairly accused of using AI. Like, an author who has never touched AI could be unfairly accused because the detectors are not reliable. At least they don't seem to be. And people could be accused of doing something they didn't do. Now writers are living in fear of this unfair accusation, which is so messed up. Like, so messed up. I heard of a writer, published author, I should say, who, to avoid any potential AI allegations, has been inviting her top readers to join in on Zoom, I think, while she writes, so that they can eventually testify on her behalf if need be. Like, a writer who's doing that should be doing that because she wants to give her fans, you know, a sneak peek into the behind the scenes. This should be fun. It should be exciting. But it's not fun or exciting. It's like, oh, I live in fear, so I'm inviting people to, you know, eventually one day be witness to what, like, what? Like, that's just terrible.
Yeah. No, I have a lot of thoughts. I started actually working on a Substack about it because I was like, I need to organize my thoughts on this. Yeah. I wasn't going to write about it. And then, like, the dialogue, the discourse will not die. So by the time this episode comes out, my Substack will be out. I have tentatively called this book publishing has an AI-shaped PR problem on its hands. In an age when institutional trust is at an all-time low, I don't know how we're going to climb out of this AI hellhole. And so there's a lot that you touched on that I definitely have touched on in my draft. I think one of the things, this, like, the allegations that writers might face, to me, is also a very serious legal issue. And I am not a lawyer, so none of this is legal advice. If authors are going to be accused of things, then, like, that's defamation, that's loss of revenue potentially for them, you know, if their books get pulled. So, like, there's a lot, there's a huge legal component to this that I think
not
is also really
not to mention the immense mental health toll, right? Like, the toll
absolutely
of a person's mental health. Like,
yes,
that destroys a person. Like,
absolutely.
Like, what is happening?
I know. Yeah, I have so many notes. I'm like, you know, I get into the deluge of it all, right? Like, just the amount of volume we're going to have to deal with. I think a huge offshoot of this problem is going to be that readers will not trust us. Consumers will not trust us. I don't know if this is happening to you, but friends are texting me, like, a book, and they'll be like, hey, this book is published, but, like, is this written by AI? They are now living in fear. They don't want to spend their $20 to $40 on something that's written by AI. That's not interesting to them. In the witch hunt piece of it all, right? Like, you know, Mia Ballard was a Black debut author. She's the one that we end up coming down on. I mean, saying we as, like, the industry and all this discourse, right? Of all the cases to come down on, this is the case that's getting so much attention. That's really curious. Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's going to be really hard to get out of this for a number of reasons. You know, publishing being so chronically understaffed is a huge issue. Like, who's going to pick up the slack here with the fact checking and the editing?
Yeah,
I don't know. I worry about young agents who are looking at tons of content, not knowing how to sort through it all. How are they going to know what's AI or not? Are we going to all have to buy this Pangram software and run things through it? But I always think, what am I going to do with that information? Say I go buy this AI detection software. Say I run things through it. I actually don't ethically think I, as a literary agent, have the right to do whatever I want with submissions. I don't believe that. I don't believe that when things come into me that I can just run them through any software. I believe that they live in my email. I look at them, I review them, and then they kind of move on through the internet. You know, maybe that's another legal conversation. But yeah, I don't think I have the right to do whatever I want with people's work. And then say something does come up, 90% perceived to be written by AI. What do I do with that information? Like, I'm not going to go out accusing authors of stuff.
Is it even reliable? Is it even reliable? Because
no.
What my understanding, again, too much information about that out there, not enough clarity. My understanding is that there are lots of false positives. And I'm not saying every time it flags that it is a false positive. I'm just saying false positives exist. right? And that's scary. Like, mm-hmm. my understanding is that neurodivergent writers and people who speak English as a second language are particularly vulnerable to false positives. And that is extra, extra scary. So, I mean, you're saying, oh, I could do this, but then I can't because it's not my right to run it through the software. Is running it through the software even something that would help, you know?
Exactly. Like what protections are we looking for? Yeah exactly. Yeah. I think the answer is just more human. Yeah.
Yes. And the one thing I will say is that a few weeks ago, you and I were discussing the whole Claude is the new Fabio. And you very intelligently asked, like, I wonder if we're in a bubble. I wonder if readers will care if something's written by AI. And I think we have the answer to that, at least for now. Readers will care. Yeah. Obviously, every reader feels differently. Every individual is different. We do not live in pluribus, thank goodness. But yeah, it seems like a lot of people care. And that's something that came out of this very wild situation.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And I talk about Jane Friedman's hot sheet all the time, which is not called the hot sheet anymore. What's it called now? It's called the...
The bottom line. The bottom line.
Yeah. Someday I will get this right. Before she even published her bottom line, she wrote this big Substack note. You know how, like, you don't just have to write a Substack post. You can also write a note, which is kind of like a long thread. Anyway, she had so many great questions. One of the questions she had, or one of the kind of comments she had was, I don't think Hachette fully understood the level of AI use in the book, and I'd be truly surprised if the editors and leaders did know about the level of AI use in the book and just thought nobody else would notice. I agree. Like, a lot of times people are picking up self-published titles, there's not a huge editing process that happens. It's like run it through a style guide, you know, for the organization. You do a copy edit often, but because the book exists out there, there's not a lot of changes that usually happen because they don't want multiple editions of the book out there. That's not the goal. So the idea is a very, very light hand. That's the goal. So yeah, I don't actually think people were actually in there in that sense.
I continue to be deeply confused by everything that happened and just listening.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still in the gathering, processing, listening stage. It is a lot. It is a lot that's happening to our world, and it's scary.
Yeah. And we also talked about, you know, our previous episode about how, you know, things can't be copyrighted if they're not, if they're not written by a human, right? And that just continues to complicate the process here, right? Because does that mean that publisher, because we've seen a lot of publishers picking up self-published titles. Does this mean that publishers are going to pick up less self-published titles because maybe there's not protections on them? Because if they're written by AI, then they can't copyright them. And then we'll go down that whole rabbit hole. I'll be interested to see if we're still seeing the same amount of self-pub books bought and kind of flipped over to trad. Because I think that that's going to make some people really nervous. And agents will have to vouch for that, right? And there's a whole other conversation to be had here, but what's the agent role in the process? How are agents talking to their authors about AI? That's a conversation that many people are having behind the scenes as well.
I have a definitive guide on AI use with my clients. Yeah. I have it's an actual document.
That's good.
It's really short. No, it's really short. Yeah. All it says is don't use it.
Yeah, stay I was going to say.
Yeah, no. It's like one line. Yeah, it's like a little picture of me,
you
know, going like this, don't do it. No. Like, I'm joking, I don't have a guide. But my point is, like, if anyone wants advice on what to do about AI, my advice,
don't
maybe it's wrong, maybe it's right, I don't know, is just stay away from the thing. Like, stay away from it.
Yes.
Like, stay away.
What is there to gain, you know? Like, I've had this rant before, but, like, what is there to gain by using it, right? If you want to be a writer, you have to do the hard stuff. There is no skipping the hard stuff. You have to do the work. And the documentation, you know, the showing multiple drafts. I understand why writers would do that. Honestly, if I was an author, I probably would do the same thing. I'd be saving my drafts in folders that are labeled and timestamped and put an external hard drive if you're actually really scared about things.
I would be recording my screen. Like, that is how paranoid I am.
Exactly.
I am a crazy person. I would be recording my screen every time I type. Like, it would be, and I might install cameras. Like, I, again, paranoid person, no one listened to me. Like, my level of paranoia is off the charts. So I don't like this.
All right, well, we're going to put a pin in AI for a very, very short break. A word from our sponsors. Hello there, writers and publishing folks. The one and only Wayday is finally here at Wayfair. From April 25th through to the 27th, you can score the best deals in furniture, decor, and more. We're talking up to 80% off with free shipping on everything. Wayfair makes it so easy to find what fits your style and your needs, whether you're looking for a new writing desk, spring decor, or outdoor essentials as the warm weather starts to ramp up. If you've been following along with me, you know I've been slowly and intentionally replacing some older pieces in our home. I finally retired a table that we've had for 15 years. I found the perfect replacement on Wayfair, a beautiful console table for my bedroom. It's exactly what I needed to hide away all those little knickknacks, and finally giving me a place to display my lovely shoe collection. Wayfair made it so simple to narrow down exactly what worked for my style and my budget. Because I'm being really selective with these upgrades, I love shopping with Wayfair Verified. It's like a shortcut to the good stuff. I love an editor's choice. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point quality inspection, so I knew I was getting a quality piece that was going to last. Plus, everything ships fast and free during Wayday. I got my table a mere days from ordering, and they kept me informed every step of the way. Instead of locking my shoes away in the back of my closet, I love having them on display. Thanks, Wayfair Verified, for helping me narrow down my choice so quickly. Wayday is the sale to shop the best deals in home. We're talking 80% off with fast and free shipping on everything. Head to wayfair.com April 25th through to the 27th to shop Wayday. That's wayfair.com. Wayfair, every style, every home. All right, we are back and we're going to talk about some closures of imprints, some layoffs, not really the fun stuff, obviously, to talk about, but it is nice to kind of, I don't know, bookmark it. Parallel it against the first half of the conversation we just had about AI. So, Cece, do you want to run us through some of the closures?
Yeah, when you were talking about how publishing houses are, you know, understaffed, people are overworked and don't have the time or the resources to do everything they have to do. In the AI discourse we were chatting about a couple minutes ago, I just kept thinking of how it's only going to get worse. I decided I was going to be an optimist and life is not making it easy for me. I had decided I was going to be an optimist. Like this is like, this is whatever. This is my life is ironic. But it feels like it's going to get worse potentially because there have been so many layoffs this year. Like we started the year with layoffs on the adult side, nonfiction, and we talked about that. And then there were layoffs at WME, right? Yeah. Like which I know is a different part, but it's still entertainment industry. And then we've had Dial Books for Young Readers just absolutely close, and like Roaring Brook Imprint closed too. And all my friends who specialize in kid lit, they are really sad and really worried. And you know, one of my friends said that this reminds her of 08. I don't know how true that is, not in the sense of her feelings, but in the sense of like, you know, in 08, there was also like a massive crisis happening in the stock market. And I don't know how much of these things go hand in hand, but the fact that that's even something that's crossed her mind is really scary. Yeah. It's just disheartening to see like jobs being lost in an industry that needs more people, not fewer people.
Yeah, it's really hard, especially when a single pocket of the industry gets hit so hard with the Roaring Brook and the Dial. Like you wonder what coordination was happening, and those are completely different publishers, but you know, you just wonder like what's in the water, the tea leaves that have been read, or just the reports that have been coming through in terms of BNN not 100%. Stocking that many kid lit books. You know, this might be a popular or unpopular opinion, which is like the celebrification of kid lit and how every celebrity has their picture book and their middle grade series, and that space eats up a lot of the bookshelf space, and it's just really hard for debuts.
And there's also a political component, right?
Totally. Like
there have been book bans and libraries being underfunded, and I don't know, because I can't possibly know, I'm not at the top making any decisions, but how much of this is coming from a place of, hey, let's not stir the pot, let's just fold imprints instead of fighting back, because you know, billionaires rule the world. It's just, again, I was going to be an optimist in 2026.
Yeah. So you know, that's really tough. One thing that, you know, semi related to that also is just the number of units of books that have been published. There's a quote from Jane Friedman's Bottom Line that said, "Bowker, the agency that issues ISBN, so ISBN is, you know, the code that's connected with the book, in the United States, reports that more than 4 million books were published in 2025, an increase of 32.5% over the previous year, 2024. Self-published works were responsible for the most of the increase, which grew from 2.5 million to 3.5 million. Remember that Bowker only reports on titles published with ISBN, so the number of titles on the market far exceeds that amount, since Amazon in particular doesn't require an ISBN for an ebook. All that to say, like, so many more titles flooding the market. consumers yes. are, you know, just getting a fire hose of content yeah. and books. Less people staffing all of these books, which just means the people who are doing the work at the publishing houses have a lot to contend with, right? And tons of self-published titles out there. Refer back to the first half of the conversation about, are these written by AI or not? There's a lot of questions here about the future of content.
So many questions. Editor turnover has been scary. I don't like it.
Yep, it is tough. There were some really solid threads going around, and I saved a couple of them. Cece, I don't know if you kind of checked them out, but just mm-hmm. talking about the editor turnover and what it's like when an editor leaves, you know, oftentimes it will be halfway through your book. You know, we've talked about this before on various elements of this podcast, whether it's on the shooting the shit side or whether it's on the books with hooks side, but it can be really hard when you lose your editor. Rachel Cargill is an author and posted on Threads on the 19th of March. I've been speaking with authors signed with major publishing houses about the experience of high turnover with their publishing teams, from editor to marketing lead. Is this something you experienced? And then tons of just like best-selling authors with blue check marks are kind of chiming in. You know, it's just really tough. Nicole Walter said, yes, the editor I signed with left in the middle of the process. I had another editor through the end who also left shortly after pub day. I was told this is common. My team was lovely, though, and I'm grateful. Like, the revolving door is so hard for people yeah. just to feel like settled and kind of understanding the mm-hmm. mission of the imprint. And there's just a million reasons why this is so tough. And we both experienced it. Roxy Henke said, yes, I've lost editors 3 times. Like, it literally happens to everybody.
Yeah, it happens to everyone. If you've been in publishing long enough, it's happened to you. And sometimes even if you've been in publishing for 5 minutes, it's happened to you. It's something that it underscores the importance of agents. Like, obviously I have this perspective. I'm an agent. I'm yeah. super biased here. I recognize that. But the fact that there's so much turnover on the editor side means that, you know, your relationship with your agent as a writer is even more important, because that is stability for you. If you have a good yeah. one, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Right. But to me, I mean, and coming back to this whole conversation that we started with about AI, and I know a lot of people are worried about their jobs. We talk about AI, we're talking about mm-hmm. layoffs, all these mm-hmm. things. I just, for one of the many, many reasons, feel so grateful for the role that I have. And I've spoken about this before. Yeah. I feel so grateful that I have a thinking job. You know, yeah. my job is using my brain, talking to people. Mm-hmm. Potentially in the future, I'm sure I can be replaced by a robot, but I really don't think a robot is going to have this much experience, knows how to do contracts, knows how to do creative, knows how to do the business, understands project management. Someday that robot will exist, but I don't think in my working lifetime. And I feel really grateful that I get to use the expertise that I have. I made a comment on Substack on my Threads about the idea where, like, if for the rest of our working lives, we're just using robot language to reply to each other in emails, like, I'm going to throw my computer into the sun. That will yeah. like, that is the exact opposite of what we got into this business to do. Let's pick up the yeah. phone more. Let's Zoom more. Let's see each other at events, because I don't want to use robot speak, you know, AI, you know, Grammarly fixed words to reply in emails back to people, when we should just be using the way that we speak. Like, the biggest flex is going to be little things like tiny spelling mistakes, you know, like those little, that's like, oh, that person made that grammar choice. That's really interesting. It's like those little inflection points, I think, are going to humanize everything. And I'm in a positive theory. I actually think literary fiction is going to have a comeback. And I've talked before about like what I think is really going to quote unquote save the business. And it's just, I've been speaking about like really original books. I actually think literary fiction is going to be the thing that saves it at the end of the day, because we've talked so much about genre fiction, all of its pros and cons. But with literary fiction, like, such intentional choices have to be made about character, about structure, about everything. And they are incredibly original pieces of work. At the end of the day, readers feel like they are losing faith in the institution of publishing. They are going to want to turn to things that they feel really original, yeah. or else we're going to lose them, right? They're not going to want to spend their $20 to $40 on a book.
They really aren't. And, you know, I think this reminds me of the importance of knowing what you want and what you want to read. I personally don't believe in censorship. I don't believe that I have the right to tell anyone what they can or can't do or write about. You mm-hmm. know, if you want to write about XYZ, you go ahead and do it. It is none of my business. I do, however, while I don't believe in censorship, I believe in curation. I want to choose what I read. I want to choose what I consume and what I digest. And I am not interested in consuming works written by AI. It's just not for me. If it's for someone else, then that's their decision to make. And I think that what's really brilliant about what literary fiction can bring to the table in this age of distrust is AI was trained by obviously being fed all sorts of literary works that exist from all sorts of genres and categories. And there's an element of interiority and vulnerability that the greats can achieve that very few authors can do, even brilliant authors, commercial authors. And there's something to be said about, you know, really diving into the human psyche, the parts that we keep completely hidden, the parts that you can't analyze by analyzing human behavior, the parts that you can't detect by looking at what we do. And I think that will be really interesting too, you know, how so much of the works that might stand out in the future will be peering behind the parts of ourselves that we aren't even prepared to look at yet, and that beautiful, talented, amazing authors will. To be a writer is to wrestle with the human condition, and how much more wrestling can we do? I think there's still so much more to uncover. Like, I think there's so much of the human psyche that still can be explored, and it'll be really cool to see literature in the future doing that.
Totally. Yeah, I want to pivot to nonfiction for a little bit. I think a lot of our focus here has been on fiction. Nonfiction, there's a really interesting article in the New Republic that came out on March 23rd, written by Paul Ellie. The nonfiction publishing under threat is more important than ever. And there's just been so much talk about everything that we can get on the internet. And there's a quote from the article that said, "People looking for information can now easily turn to chatbots, YouTube, podcasts, and other free online sources." And so I actually had a call with an editor from a Big Five on the nonfiction. Well, she does half fiction, half nonfiction, but we were talking about nonfiction specifically. And she was talking about a couple books that did really well for them and why she thinks, with, again, all of this coming down on nonfiction, why those ones particularly did really well. And she said, it's a mix of serious but joyful, or serious and hope. Like, we can't really be all doom and gloom right now, because, again, that's everything we're getting from the news. A lot of fiction readers want escapism, but with nonfiction, it's like you want that information, but you need that joy and you need that hope. And like, that's the reason that we're coming to nonfiction. And it reminds me of the book that I was talking about off the top, which is Art Cure. You know, it's like, it's the mix of art, it's a mix of science, you know, the knowledge of art therapy, the science of art therapy, and how it all works. And so there's things like that where I think there's still so much to be uncovered on the nonfiction side, but we really need a path out. The nonfiction that's not really working right now is just like, it's all doom and gloom. It's all doom and gloom, right? Because it's like, well, yeah, we can get that information from anywhere, but we need the experts that are going to help us find a way out and find a way through this with hope and with joy.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. So we will end on good news in the hopes of restoring optimism to my goals. The HarperCollins Union ratified a new contract, and they secured the highest starting pay in publishing. And that is wonderful, wonderful news. Do I think the starting pay should be even higher? Absolutely, I do. Everyone does. But it is still good news. It's good news that not too long ago, I believe they had the lowest pay of the Big Five, or it was something similar to that. And now they have the highest. And that is a wonderful thing. So the new contract mandates a starting salary of $52,500 for a 35-hour week, which again is the highest in the industry. There's also other great benefits too, like all covered employees will get annual pay increases, time and a half for overtime. Employees at the beginning of their careers can work up to 3 hours of overtime per week without prior approval. So yeah, it's actually really, really good news. And I'm excited about that and very, very proud of the work that they've done and grateful that they are fighting the good fight, because it is hard work to do. And thanks to them, everyone's lives are going to be a little bit better.
Totally. And that will help raise across the board, right? Because that will help competition with the other large publishers. So we love to see it. Happy about that. So let's pay our people well. That's kind of all we had for today, guys. So thanks for hanging out with us. It was jam-packed. We look forward to hearing what you think. You can also head over to my Substack, The Weekend Rant, because I have posted a lot of my thoughts there on this topic as well. And we'll see you over there. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
CC Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query CC, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.